Unveiled with Niamh and Nessa, a Go Loud original podcast.
Everyone, you're very welcome back to Unveiled. This is a Go Loud original podcast and we're so excited to have you listening in this week because this is a very interesting topic for me. If some of you might follow me on Instagram, and even if you don't, I'm sure a lot of people listening will understand the struggles at the moment to be, you know, getting a house, getting a mortgage, the bidding wars, all that kind of thing. So we have the lovely Martina here from Doddle, and it's so nice to have you. How are you?
I'm great. Delighted to be here.
Sure, introduce us and tell us a little about what you do and what Doddle does.
Yeah, so Martina Hennessy is my name. Mm-hmm. I run a business called Doddle, and Doddle is a mortgage intermediary. So we're like a mortgage broker. Mm-hmm. We would work with our clients to secure like products for them, whether it's mortgages, life cover, general insurance that best suits their needs. So instead of just working or going to one bank for your mortgage, we offer market-based advice. So we would work with all major lenders, all insurance providers in Ireland. And when you would come to us, we would say, okay, what do you want to achieve? And we would work to find the best, if it's mortgage, which most of our business is mortgage related. If it's mortgage, we would look to find the best mortgage for you. And that can be based on the amount you want to borrow, the rates you want to achieve. And ultimately, we're trying to get what's right for you at that particular time and to work with you right from inquiry through to when you get the keys to your new home. So it's end to end.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. And how early on should you start the broker kind of journey?
So most people, if they're saving, it takes so long to save. We all know how difficult it is to save a 10% mm-hmm. deposit. So most people will have some idea as to what the mortgage market's like. You know, when you're in that research zone, you're like looking at everything, you're trying to understand how everything works, what you need to do. So I would always say that probably 12 months before you want to apply, you should check in with a broker and just say, okay, this is what I'm looking to achieve. I'm saving X. This is my role. I plan to stay in it, or I'm thinking about moving jobs and all those pieces that impact your mortgage. Mm-hmm. So when you're applying for a mortgage, there's kind of three key elements. It's like income, deposit and affordability. So if you understand how mortgages work and those three key principles, you will be successful in making the mortgage application. And the 6 months immediately preceding application is really important, because that's when your bank statements, when you submit your bank statements for an application, it's the 6 months before you want to apply. So you need to kind of understand what you should be doing. When you're saving, you need to get some advice. There's lots of schemes for first-time buyers on the market. So getting as much advice as possible and starting that kind of relationship early is great. I would say 12 months ideal, but 6 months for sure before you want to buy, so that you can plan.
Oh, amazing. So someone can just book in, ring you up and just be like, look, I'm looking to buy a house in the next, you know, a year or two, and you can give them all the advice and then they start from there.
Exactly. Yeah. So we would work with clients early doors and we would kind of set them up and say, okay, this is what you need to do. Mm-hmm. We would say, this is what you can expect to borrow. Because a lot of people at the starting point, they've never done this before, if they're first time buyers in particular, they don't know what to expect. So we would run through, this is what you can achieve in terms of mortgage amount based on your income. And that kind of defines then, okay, well, that's my budget. And okay, I need to save more, or I need to look at first homes or new homes because I need to avail of maybe the first home scheme as it stands now, or the help to buy scheme. So it's all that early advice. And otherwise, like everything else, if you start Googling or looking at different, you know, forums or following different people, sometimes it can get really conflicting advice. Mm-hmm. So it's good to have somebody who you know is going to be your partner right through the process and to get clear advice from the outset so you know where you stand.
Just on that, Martina, I think, because I know obviously I'm lucky enough to have bought a house and we used a broker, and I think at the start I couldn't comprehend that the broker had your back rather than the bank's. But that's the case with, like, the broker is out for you.
Yeah.
And like, you might just give a line on that because I feel like people don't really understand.
No, definitely. And like, we explain this every day. And my most common question on Instagram is like, what's your fee? Right?
Yeah.
What's your charge?
Yeah.
What do you do? Oh, where's the catch? Yeah. Right? Because our role, when we're working with a client, like, our role is to find them the best product. We are distribution channel for all the lenders. So if you go into one bank, they'll tell you what their products are, they'll tell you what their rates are. But as a broker, we look at the whole market. And whether you take your mortgage with Bank A or Bank B, mm-hmm. it doesn't make a difference to us financially, because we get paid by the lender you choose to take your mortgage with. So if you take your mortgage with Bank A or Bank Z, it makes no difference. We get paid the exact same amount. And the reason we get paid by the banks is because we do all of the groundwork in terms of the full application process, where your point of contact project right from start to completion. And our sole role is to make sure you get the best product. So we work on behalf of the client. We don't charge a fee. Some brokers may charge an administration fee, but we don't, because again, we all get paid from the lender. And that's instead of them having their own staff and office costs to procure the, you know, mortgages or whatever it is, a life project or whatever it might be. So fully on your behalf.
Totally. Like, everybody needs to listen to that twice because I can't comprehend why anyone would want to go that alone because you're worth your weight in gold. You have so much knowledge, a broker does, because it's most people don't have banking insights.
Yeah, so, and I'm definitely a bit biased, but like when you look at it, if you're a first time buyer, it's the first time you've ever gone through it, right? Yeah. It's so overwhelming.
Totally.
You don't know what to expect, what not to expect. In some ways, you're just kind of going, just get me mortgage, right? But you have to get the right mortgage, or else it will cost you. And you have to have, I think, that kind of support and partner. And sometimes clients will come to us and go, I don't know if I should tell you this. And you're like, well, no, tell
it. Yeah, get it all out there.
Because we can figure everything out. Yeah. We know our role is to present your application to a bank so it'll be successfully approved. Mm-hmm. So the documentation piece for any mortgage is always the tedious bit, putting together the bank statements.
Yeah.
And our role is to get all that together, package it, do a really solid credit proposal for the bank to say, this is why you should lend to this person.
Well, so with that, that kind of brings us on to our next point there. Like, when you're doing that package up process, like, what are the red flags people really should be avoiding if they're trying to get approved for a mortgage?
Yeah, so I suppose what the bank are really looking at is, have you demonstrated that you can, one, afford the mortgage, and that you clearly can show that you can repay it, right? So that's all they want. You know, the mortgage is a security on the property, but the bank always wants you to pay the mortgage. They don't want to get into a position where you're going to be in arrears. And as much as they can look at the risk on your application, they will. So when they're looking at your application, they're looking and saying, are you in permanent employment? Or if you're self-employed, what's your track record on earnings? Can it be seen that the income you have now that they're taking into account for the assessment will be in place going forward so that you can afford to pay the mortgage? So they're lending prudently, I suppose. Then they're looking at your deposit and they're looking at, how have you saved that? You know, is it a gift? Are you using the Help to Buy scheme? So, and then they're looking at, how have you shown over the last 6 months that you could repay this mortgage? So your mortgage has to be paid every single month. And they're looking and saying, okay, if you want to borrow, say, 300,000, they will look and they'll say, how can you show that you can afford that? And they, what they'll do is they'll add 2% to the rate that exists now. So it's not the repayment you're going to be making. They'll stress test it, just in case rates go up, will it still be affordable? So for every 100,000 that you want to borrow, the bank generally wants to see €600 per month in repayment capacity. So if you want to borrow 300,000, that's 1,800. And that can be by way of your rent, savings, loans that are discontinuing. So once the mortgage draws down, what are the things that you're doing now that would be replaced by that? Okay. And if they can see that for 6 months, then great. But sometimes when you're coming up to a mortgage, you're saying, my last blowout, I'm going to go on holidays before I buy, and you have a depletion in your savings, or you don't save in a particular month, the bank are going to go, because every month you have to pay your mortgage. You can't say, actually, I wanted to go on holidays. Yeah. So those things they look at. If you're looking to change jobs, right, there's generally, if you're a PAYE employee, right, if you change jobs, your contract will generally state that there's 6 months probation. So think about things like that, because if you move roles, you may not be able to secure a mortgage during that probation period, because the bank wants to see, have you settled in? Are you fully permanent? I.e., is your probation complete? Mm-hmm. So things like that. I suppose missed payments would be the one on credit cards and, you know, prior credit facilities or anything that's in your account, like missed direct debits, really being consistent with savings. So if you're saying, I save €1,000 a month, does that €1,000 go into the savings account and does it stay there? Yeah, you know, a lot of my clients say, save 2,000 a month. I'm like, oh, brilliant. And you get the statements like, that's kind of 2,000 going back out.
Moved
that same
it out
month.
There. Yeah. like, I saved it, but then I moved it back in.
Yeah, I saved it, but then I sold this. Because I was trying to keep it fairly consistent.
You can't do that. That's so boring.
Yeah, really. Mortgages are boring.
Yeah. I'm nearly at the mortgage approval part and I have been using yourself, which has been very enjoyable, I have to say. So thank you so much. Me and Jamie have found the experience with Doddle really easy and so informative, and you just send us off to get our bits and you do the rest. Like, it's really amazing. But we have started going out there now, you know, viewing houses, and to be honest, it feels a little bit bleak. Like, we look at like some of the houses that we're going for, and we would have the luxury of getting a new build, but we're not near any of our family, so new builds of where we want to live are non-existent, and we're going like heading into like bidding wars. So how is it possible? Like, because if you look at the average house price at the moment, you know, that's selling is like 575, and I put up on my Instagram, they're going out like over 100 grand over the asking price. How are you finding people, like just from your experience with other people getting mortgages, how are they getting on, or how are they getting houses or?
Yeah, it's a real struggle. God, I think everybody knows, you know, that it is a real struggle. So for some of my clients, like, the mortgage seems to be the daunting bit at the start, and then they go, actually, no, like until you're in it, you don't realise that the house hunting piece is difficult. So when you buy a new build, there's no bidding war. But when you are buying a second-hand home, that's where the real challenge is. So with a new build, the price on the list price is the price, and you buy it and you're going great. But with second-hand homes, there is that bidding process. And the problem sometimes with the bidding process is, first of all, there's a, you know, there's an asking price, and you go great and you go to a viewing, and then bidding starts. And as you say, it climbs up so fast and so quickly sometimes. And then in your mind,
and so much.
Oh, so much. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you're going like, should I hold out? Do I go back in? You've all these mind games. And when you haven't done that before, when you really love a home, that's a real challenge. A lot of my clients would say that, like, trying to go to viewings, keep up with where property was, or a particular property they're interested in, what the sales price was and what they should be looking at in that area and how to compare it, is like a full-time job. So it is a massive commitment. And when clients actually go sale agreed, and I'm like, come on, your sale agreed's amazing, and they're like, just glad I don't have to look at houses anymore. So it is a big commitment. And I think anybody that's in any way looking at property or looking for mortgages or in general aware of what's happening in the market knows how challenging it is, and the supply versus the demand. In our business, there's huge demand constantly. People want to buy. People can afford the mortgages. The problem is affordable homes in some ways, but also the number of homes that come to market. Like, all the recent statistics show that it's, you know, the lowest level it has been for 14 years. So it can seem really, really grim. But the one thing I would say is that all of my clients at some point buy. It just takes, in some, longer than others. So some clients will say, I hope to buy in the next 6 months, and then they come back after the weekend, because I've put down a deposit. And others are, you know, it takes so much longer. It takes, you know, approval is generally valid for 6 months. And sometimes clients are coming back to us on their third approval. Oh, and when they go sale agree, they're the ones you're like, really, yay! So,
The third approval that you're saying there, I don't know what the actual terminology is, like remortgage or whatever, you can correct me on that. Do you have to go through the whole thing again if your mortgage expires?
So if you get your mortgage approval in principle and you have that, you've put in all your documentation. If you find a property during that 6 months, that then moves forward to a loan offer. But if you don't, you do have to apply again. Now, you'll generally know that you're going to be approved for the mortgage. But the one thing I'd say is, if you have your approval and you suddenly go, okay, well, I'm approved now and I can stop saving, or I can do X, Y, or Z. Just be mindful that if you do need to go in for approval again, it will be assessed as if it's a new application.
Oh my God.
Oh God, I didn't know.
Oh yeah, I'm watching you.
Yeah, you will be watching me.
That's so important though, because I feel like you might think you're in the clear and then it expires and you're like, no.
Yeah, and we would have a really big cautionary tale to our clients, go, don't go mad now. This is you have to maintain this. Yeah. Or if something changes, if you lose your job, or if you want to move jobs, check in with us. Because most things, you know, like that, you can legislate for, you can speak to the lender about. You know, the banks actually want to lend. And I think that's a really good point to make, because sometimes it's like, oh my God, it's, you know, banks don't, or I didn't get approved enough. They actually want to lend. So it's just always about making sure you're presenting yourself as, a less risk, so a creditworthy person. And something like that is, if there's a blip in a 6 month period, you can always explain it to a lender, but they need to understand the mitigants, like why was there, or what's happening. Or if you move jobs, you can sometimes, or in a lot of cases, you can get the probation waived if you build a strong enough case. So
so I have another kind of two important questions for you, because I was a second time buyer going in. I bought a house madly when I was like 24 anyway, sold that, so I didn't really have the benefits of the first time, you know, help to buy scheme. But can you actually talk, I suppose, and then I'll ask, what are the benefits for second time buyer, if there's any? But can you talk us through, like, so someone who's buying their first home, first time buyer, the help to buy?
Yeah. So it's,
and
so
the first home
scheme.
What are the differences with that?
Yeah, no, perfect. Because when you read them, and actually I put up a question box last weekend on Instagram, it was like the questions that came in, I was like, what? Like, people, it's so hard to understand them, because you read it and you're like, I still don't know what that means, right? So the Help to Buy scheme is the one that's been in place for a number of years. So that's where, for first-time buyers, both schemes are for first-time buyers only, and you have to be purchasing a new build property. Okay. With the Help to Buy scheme, what that is it's a rebate of the tax you've paid over the last 4 years. So if you've been working in Ireland and you've been paying tax, you can claim, you can put in an application to be assessed under the Help to Buy scheme. And what that will give you is a rebate of the tax you've paid, and it can be up to 10% of the purchase price of the property capped at 30,000. So that's like part of your deposit. So if you're buying a new build for, say, 400,000, right?
Because this is just for new build.
Just new builds. Okay. Yeah, just new builds. So if you're buying, say, a home for 400,000, because it's really hard to get new builds, that will be, you know, that's all my clients will be like, it's really hard to get new builds first and then affordable new builds.
Yeah.
But if you're buying a property, say it's 400,000, you will be able to, and you're eligible for the full Help to Buy, you will be eligible for that 30,000. So technically, you would only then have to have a 10,000 euro deposit. So if it's 10% of the purchase price, you're 30 from the Help to Buy, and then you'd have to have your transaction costs, because there's still stamp duty and legal fees, which are the additional costs.
I know.
So that is, so you'd apply, you don't have to have property in mind to apply. You apply on your My Account on Revenue and they will come back and say, great, you're eligible for X. You go house hunting, you put your name down on a property, and when you're signing contracts, so the contracts are signed and the letter of offer is there from the bank, both of those are uploaded to Revenue, and then the funds are transferred to the developer's account basically via VAT, etc. So you have, it's 30,000 off the purchase price, and it can form part of your 10% deposit when you're going to buy. Now, the things to be mindful on that is you have to have a loan to value, which is mortgage divided by the value of the property, of 70%. So you can't have more than the 30% deposit. Like, chance would be a fine thing, right? If you're for most first time buyers, they will absolutely meet that. But just, you can't have more, you can't have a loan to value less than that. So if you're a really chunky deposit, it won't be applicable. And the cap on the purchase price of the property is 500,000. So if you're, if there's properties that are over that, you don't get the Help to Buy. So it's 500,000. In terms of the price?
Yeah, like I don't know.
A lot of new builds are like 600 grand plus.
I think I totally get it. Like, right? They were trying to do when they brought it in initially, right, was to say it's not going to be a wealthy, big, expensive home. Yeah. But the reality is, most new build homes are more expensive than that.
Yeah.
And are standard.
So, yeah.
Like, it's not like they're mansions. They're just,
absolutely. Yeah. Now, there's a huge volume of applications for the Help to Buy. So the Help to Buy takes about 6 to 8 weeks to come through. So just if you are intending to purchase property and it's going to be a new build, or even if you just are house hunting, get your Help to Buy in place, because if you go sale agreed in the property and then you have to wait 6 to 8 weeks to know what you're going to get, it's worth having it. The applications and the demand, right, for new homes is so clear, right? So you can see that in the first 2 months of this year, there was over 12,000 applications for the Help to Buy. That was the same as the whole year of 2022. Wow. Do you know what I mean? Like, just a volume of applications for the Help to Buy.
Incredible.
Shows demand. Yeah. And then the obvious issue is the supply of new homes. You know, 30,000 built last year, 10,000 were mortgageable. The rest were either social and affordable homes or built to rent.
Wow.
So it is that challenge of the supports are there, but the homes are not necessarily there. And the affordable homes are the challenge.
And so that was amazing to get a full deep dive on the Help to Buy. What is the difference then with first, what is it called?
The First Home Scheme, yeah.
Because so, when I'm like, am I mixing that up? But that's what it's called,
and
right?
Sometimes when I'm talking about them, because they're all different acronyms, you get it wrong too. So the First Home Scheme then is when you're buying a new built home again as a first time buyer, and you're eligible for X mortgage amount. Say it's 250,000 and you have savings of, say, 20,000 and you want to buy a property for 300,000. The Help to Buy, or the First Home Scheme, is to, designed to bridge the gap between your mortgage level and the deposit you have versus the purchase price of the property. And what happens is there's a fund, which is the Help to Buy Scheme Fund, which was partly by, it's a special purpose vehicle to be technical, but it's by, with the government and participating lenders. So your main pillar banks participate in it. And there's a fund that's there. And what the fund does is it buys an equity stake in your home. So it's saying, okay, you need, and if you it can be up to 30% of the purchase price if you're not availing of the Help to Buy, or 20% if you are.
Wow.
So if you think about it, and you're somebody saying, God, I'm really struggling to build my deposit and I'm really, really struggling to buy, those two supports can help in that you, say, for example, you can borrow 200,000, just to make it really simple, and you're going to have, you've 20,000 yourself, that brings you to 220. If you want to purchase property for 300,000, you're going to get 30 from the Help to Buy scheme. So that brings you to 250. The First Home Scheme can then bridge the gap between the other 50. They would give you 50,000 for an equity stake for the percentage that they would have in the value of your home. So they would have a sixth of the value of your home.
Yeah.
You don't have to pay that back.
I'm like, what's the catch?
You don't have to pay it back unless only on death, if you sell the property, if it's no longer your principal private residence, or if you move out from one of the lenders that are privy to the scheme, so the main lenders are. And what happens is you can choose to buy it back. So they're going to own, say, for example, 20% or 30% if you took the full equity stake. They're going to own that in your home. Well, but you don't... You do at some point where obviously you sell the home or on death, etc. But you don't necessarily have to pay it back. Mm. It's not like a mortgage where you pay a sum back every month. You do pay a service charge from year five. So that's like 1.25% from year five, etc. But it's a means for somebody to get on the property ladder. And if, for example, you felt, okay, I'm at the start of my career, or I know I'm going to earn more money, or I get lots of commission or variable income, or I'm self-employed and I can't borrow the full extent that I want from the bank, it's an option for you to take it to avail of the first home scheme. You can always repay the amount. So you could decide next year, I have a lump sum of 20,000, I'm going to pay some of that back, and you can get a valuation of the house and pay back some of that equity stake.
That's what I wanted to ask you. Is it a fixed value, or does it increase and decrease depending on the value of the property?
It does.
Okay.
So say, for example, you purchased and you took a 20% equity stake and it was 300,000. So you got 60,000 from the first home scheme. And then you said next year, God, I'd like to pay some of this back. But the value of the home had gone up to 350.
Yeah.
The amount you have to pay back is 70. But if it had gone down to 250, the amount you pay back is 50.
Right.
So it depends. The equity stake is set when you purchase. And then if you want to repay it, if you choose to repay it, because remember, you don't have to.
Don't pay that back.
Yeah.
Anyone has that, don't pay it. Why would you?
And you know, sometimes people say, is it another mortgage? It's like another charge on your property.
Yeah.
But if you think of a mortgage, like, and do I not own my home? You kind of don't own it until your mortgage paid. Anyway, the bank have your deeds.
Sorry, that sounds unreal.
Louis came in, it was the year before last, right? So it was 2022. Last year, then they enhanced it to allow people who are building a home to be able to avail of it.
Okay.
And this year, actually, what they did was, if you were renting and your landlord was selling the home that you were renting, they would allow you to buy the property off your landlord.
Okay.
So, so that really has helped a lot of people. Anybody who understands it, it's funny. You go, God, that really will help me and make sense. And especially even I would think some of my colleagues who availed of it, we'd be going, that's good work for you, you know, because if you have a plan that perhaps you could pay it off longer term, or you might say, well, actually, I prefer to pay the mortgage and this can roll. And if I sell the house, if it's my first home, and obviously I'm just going to sell it in 5 years' time, we can clear the equity piece off then, and we have the chunk of it ourselves. So it's a really good scheme. And again, when you're buying, you need to know about all of these schemes and you need to understand them. But it's kind of hard. When I would speak to clients, we would do examples and specifics, and we'd say, and this is what you could buy if you're buying a second-hand home because you have your deposit of X. This is what it would be if you were buying a new home, and if you just use the help to buy, be this, or this is where you could go to with the first home scheme. So it's understanding what the options are.
There's a lot of options, but my next question is, because I'm a second time buyer, what are the options for a second time buyer?
And this is terrible that there are none.
I know the answer to this, but I just for anyone listening.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So the government, all of the new schemes, and it's much to many of my clients' frustration, but most of the new schemes are focused at first-time buyers, and they're focused at new homes.
Yeah.
So another frustration is for first-time buyers, they're like, why can't I use the first home scheme or the help to buy for second-hand homes?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just the government are supporting the building of new homes. They want to encourage people to buy new homes, to live in communities that are serviced and that have infrastructure.
Yeah.
Second time buyers, unfortunately, there is none. And the only difference on lending
Genuine
rules.
Region.
Yeah.
We probably weren't going to buy a new build anyway. Wasn't in our. There actually was a little new build built just up the road from Jamie's, but they're all gone. They were only building 10 houses.
And all developments are gone before they even come up. You know, it's hard. So I will always say to my clients, be aware of what's being built around you.
Yeah.
And even look at the planning website, what's coming into being built, and then being onto the agents constantly. Because before a development's launched, there's usually a pre-launch, or there's usually a list, or at least if it is going to be launched, understand what the site layout looked like. What would be your preferred house? That would be one, number one, two, and three. So that if you go in and one's gone, you might get
that's
two or three.
We did. We were literally like, that one, please. Yes. Then we were like, what the hell did we just drive by?
I know.
We're like, oh, it has a roof, great.
I know. And you can't see it generally. You're looking at a show house. But yeah, at least if you're aware of what's there, rather than going in and going, oh my God, maybe I'll take that one. And you're not sure of
you're like, I don't care. It's a house. Great. I know. Perfect.
Yeah. Second time buyers, I'm afraid.
I know.
Yeah.
Because you're on the ladder already.
So. They assume that, but you know, a lot of people have different circumstances. Totally. They wouldn't have this big equity piece. Now, in fairness, last year, the central bank changed the rules. You used to have a 20% deposit. Now
I know,
it's just
10. Actually kind of were saving for the 20%.
Yeah.
I'm actually glad I did. So when they lowered the rate or whatever, me and Jane were like, oh, but like, it's actually kind of nice. We've saved a chunk now.
And the more deposit you have, if you could hit that 80% loan to value bracket, it's really good from a rate perspective because some of the lenders will have lower rates depending on your loan to value. So the more deposit you have, the less risk for them, and they'll reward you by giving you a lower rate.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe we should just save some more then. Or save like another...
Yeah, don't fix yourself. You don't want to be saving too long. It means you haven't bought.
I know. That's true.
So can you explain the difference in criteria for self-employed or like if you're building? Because I know we've spoken a lot there about kind of predominantly the first-time buyers. We don't really need to talk about second-time buyers. They've done it. They know. Yeah. But like there's a lot of self-employed people out there. So,
and I'm self-employed myself and I'm chartered accountant. Yeah, so we're all kind of in the same mix of, self-employed is slightly different to obviously a PAY employee, PAYE, you have your payslips, you have your job, you have your salary search, you have a P60 or equivalent, which is now called the ETS. So for self-employed applicants, the banks are always looking retrospectively. So they're looking and saying, what was your income? What can you show us, over the last 2 years? So they'll take an average of your prior 2 years' income. And that will be your accounts if you're a sole trader, your P&L. If you have a limited company, your P&L balance sheet, so your full accounts. And they'll also look at just what's the movement. Like, are your sales or your turnover higher year on year? Are they stable? What's your profit like? What are your expenses and your costs like? But the figure that they generally take is what is in your tax return, right? Because it's always taxable income that services a mortgage. So what's on your Form 11 and Chapter 4 receipt? So they're the two documents your accountant will have gotten once they've done your tax return and you've paid over your tax bill. So those documents dictate what your earnings are. So the bank will take the average of the last two. So it'll be 2023 if you filed it, 2022. And they'll say, well, that's your average earning. And so that was really difficult for a lot of people over COVID when they were self-employed. Yeah. Lots of different industries were hit. So it has taken people a long time to kind of come back up to where they maybe once were. Yeah. And that average is really strict. Like, that's what the banks stick to. Now, if your latest year is lower because you were on mat leave or because you were, you went traveling for 6 months or just there was a downturn in your industry, you can look to try and make a case for that. So we'd always look to try and make a case for the client. We might look over a 3 year period then and say, well, what's better? You know, what kind of figures look better and how can we present this to the bank in the best way? So they will always look retrospectively. So some of my clients say, I'm applying for a mortgage. So this year I decided to pay myself 80,000. I paid myself 30 in the last number of years, and you're like, they won't just take that because it's not proven over multiple periods. So just be aware of that. And the other thing for self-employed applicants is, you might have rent, you might be working from home and have rent, or you might have expenses or mileage or anything like that. It cannot be taken into account because it's taxable income only. Okay. So just to be aware of that when you're planning, when you're self-employed, it nearly takes a little bit longer to plan to understand how much you can borrow because it is that retrospective view on your earnings as opposed to your future or current state. Sometimes contractors, if you've signed a new contract, if you're an IT contractor, for example, and you're self-employed and you have a longer term contract that states you're earning X, there might be some leeway there. But I always think self-employed applicants should go to a broker because if you go to one bank, you're just getting one set of criteria and they mightn't have the most favourable view on what your income is or how they assess it. Or, some lenders will add back profit if you're a limited company and there's profit in your account. So there's various different ways. And it's harder for self-employed individuals because they're not only looking at you and your own individual accounts, but they're looking at your business, the industry you're in, how your business is performing. Have your cost increased? Has your profit decreased? Are there any commitments in the business? Have you given any personal guarantees if it's a limited company? Or have you taken out any loans if you're a sole trader and you've taken out loans for equipment or a car or whatever? that even though it is paid by the business, it's still a commitment that will come up on your own credit record. Okay. Yeah. So it'll be taken into account.
And just really quickly then on if you're building.
Building. So we would have a lot of clients who would build. So some people are lucky to have sites, which is fantastic. Mm. Or some people just want to build and they buy a site and build. So the big thing is if you're gifted a site, great, because that's like your deposit. You own that site and you could, yeah, I know, I'm a farmer's daughter. I keep going road frontage. Yeah.
We're not.
Yeah. I can fix you up with sites.
Okay, great. Yeah, yeah, come back. Give it to fiancés would be great. You'll understand.
Yeah, but so look, if you want to build, the big challenge at the moment, obviously, it's so expensive to build, right? So the costs have gone up so significantly. But if you have a site and you want to build, the big thing is you've planning permission in place. You can actually, if you own the site, you can borrow potentially up to 100% of the build cost, provided your overall loan to value is not over 90%. So if there's a value in the site, generally, you can borrow up to 100% of the build cost because that value will... the value of the site, bring it down lower. So for somebody who's looking to build from a mortgage point of view, it's a much longer process, right? Because first of all, you have to do, you have to ensure the planning is in place. You have to get a breakdown of the costing. And as the build progresses, you draw down what's called stage payments. So a banker never going to lend you more than 90% of the value of what's there and what's being built. So the funds are released by way of stage payments as the build progresses. So the builder says, I need 50,000 for my next stage. And the architect or engineer will go out and go, yes, the work is completed. They'll do a sign off on the site that it's all in accordance with planning, building regs, etc. And we would send that if we were working with the client, or it would go into the bank and the bank would release that 50,000 to pay the builder. We'd come back again in a month's time and, you know, the same thing would happen. So it's a much longer stage process. You only pay as you draw down funds. So that's good. And the good thing about obviously building a home or a new built home is that from a rate perspective, you're eligible for green rates. So green rates are where your building energy rating is B3 or above. All new homes, or 99% of new homes actually built in the last 5 years were A rated. So you'd be eligible for green rate. So you're entitled to the best rates in the market, and it is a significant challenge. And the big thing I'd say is make sure you've enough in terms of contingency, because sometimes you'll say, Johnny could do that and Nick's are from somewhere, right? And then you're kind of going, oh God, actually, it's all gone over and above what we thought it would be. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's more challenging. So I'd always say to my clients, go with what you think it is plus 10% if you can, from a mortgage perspective, get approval for that and draw down then just what you need. You know what I mean?
Dermot Bannon has taught us all that.
I think Dermot Bannon, I'd be like, oh my God, don't tell him you have a budget at all. I'd be like, well over.
Budget, it's fine.
Well over.
Monty Surveyor is like, are you joking?
I would tell you, I don't know. I'd be really worried.
He's a visionary.
Yeah, he is. All the houses are amazing, but you're like, oh. Self-builds. And somebody who's looking to renovate a property or buy a property that needs work, that's also possible. Again, the bank will allow you to borrow to buy a second-hand home, and they will lend you the money to do it up if the works add value and if you're obviously eligible for the total mortgage amount that you want to borrow.
Wow.
So that turns people off. You know, with second-hand properties, they go in and go, oh God, I'd need, 50,000 to do X, Y, and Z, new kitchen, new bathroom, extension, whatever. But you can actually add that onto your mortgage. So say, for example, you were approved to buy a home for 400,000 and your mortgage was 360. Mm. And then you saw a house for 350, but it needed 50K worth of work. You can do that, right? You can get the costing for the works. We could go into the bank and say, okay, we're going to borrow 90% of the 350 to... Mm. Did she say you should do that?
Yeah, we've considered all that.
Yeah.
But like the do-overs are still gone over 100 grand over the asking price at this point. Yeah.
But you know, it's funny. I do think that there's probably less people looking at the do-overs because a lot of the time people don't realise they can do it, and at particular price points as well, right?
Yeah.
So you might have somebody who's selling a house that has equity and whatever else, or a larger deposit, and they're at the kind of 600 to 700, and they're willing to do work for a family home, that kind of 600 mark. But at the kind of, 3 to 5, you will find that there's less interest in property that needs work because those buyers at that price point don't actually have the excess deposit to be able to put into it, and they're unaware that they can actually in some ways finance the work.
That's so amazing.
Depends at different markets.
Maybe amazing's a stretch, but like, you know what I mean?
It's handy. Yeah. Like, it is great because it opens up a different market to you. You know, you're kind of saying, okay, well, I could buy a property that needs work then.
Yeah. Wow. I'm learning loads.
You going to sell and buy your house?
Maybe. No.
Going to move down the country. Yeah.
Do you want to buy it?
Exactly.
Yeah, I'm going to Clonmel to find a farmer.
Buy a few of those for you.
Yeah.
What do you think the main things people should consider when buying a house?
Look, it's always, it's really hard because sometimes it's like you start with this wish list and you say, I really want X, Y, and Z. And then as you start to look for homes, sometimes that wish list can fall
depletes
off.
Massively.
Yeah,
I
yeah. Know. Yeah, sometimes it does, right? So it's kind of saying, okay, area in most cases, yeah. right? And, you know, for most people, they want to live in a particular area, they work in a particular area, their mm-hmm. business, where they're from or family or whatever. So that's for most people.
Yeah.
Most other things can kind of be worked around. You may not get the perfect home immediately, right? You may not, it might be you'll walk in and go, God, like I put my bang for buck, I'm not getting much here. But, you know, it's about buying the home and what you can do to it afterwards. And then I think, you know, I suppose it's just being open to a lot of things, you know, open to those properties that need work or open to looking at new builds when you think, oh, no, they're not for me, you know, because things come up that you don't expect will be right for you. But it's because it's so challenging to buy because there's so little supply, you kind of have to be open, I think.
Yeah, no, I know. I'm just thinking of like my lovely house, me and Jamie. We're looking at a gorgeous house on Saturday, but it was a wish list kind of thing, dream home. But it just went over. We got outbidded, basically. And that's probably another question that I'm probably want to ask you, but that's a few minutes down the line.
What about, you know, like gambling? Or do you know those? Like,
you see, I always laugh because people always go, you know, no gambling. And I'm going, that's not obvious. Don't be going crazy. Like, you can absolutely do a Paddy Power on a Saturday, or you can do Lotto or Cheltenham comes, but like, not consistently.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
anybody
yeah.
who's going for a mortgage, you kind of go, if you don't do that, if you're doing that, like, you're not going to, you know what I mean? Yeah. The reality is you're not going to get approval. So, I always laugh when the first thing on a wish list is like, or, you know, on that list of don'ts is no gambling.
Yeah.
You kind of go, it's kind of, there's a bit more to it. Like, there's more than that. So, the banker looking at kind of the overall risk.
Yeah.
So yes, there's no gambling, right? Everything is within reason.
Yeah.
Again, the banks want to lend, but they're looking at the risk of the applicant.
Yeah.
So if you have, you know, pages on your Revolut, and they look at your Revolut, so people don't think, they go, oh, my Revolut, you want to see that?
Yeah, like, yeah, yeah,
yeah, definitely do. I don't, but the bank do. Yeah, so they're looking at your overall profile and your overall risk. So gambling isn't that you can't have a flutter again for Cheltenham or whatever it might be. It's just the consistent gambling. And sometimes we would have clients who say, like, your statements show a lot of gambling, and the banks aren't going to be impressed. They go, but I'm winning. But I'm winning. I'm up. And you're like, it's not that. No. It's more the risk that's attached
yeah.
to it.
Yeah.
So, and then some clients will say to me, oh my God, like, I spend a lot in Zara. I'm going to take cash out. And it's not that, or whatever it might be. Banks know that you live, right? So as long as you are showing the affordability, your rent, your savings, etc., they're not looking to say, well, what else is she doing on a Friday night or whatever, within reason,
totally.
Right? So it's always, it's just that kind of normal behavior, and just try and think of it from what they're looking at. They're just looking to make sure you will repay this loan.
Okay. So Martina, there's a lot of chatter just kind of everywhere, like even in friends groups, like we put boxes up on Instagram. It's in the news at the moment as well. Just that it's just an all-time the pits to try and buy in Ireland. Like an average three-bed house in Dublin now, 517k, I think the latest DAF report is. Like, do you think the government is doing enough to set home buyers up for success to try and get on the ladder?
Yeah, so like I see it every day in my business, like just the housing crisis, right? So I'm talking about from a buyer's perspective. It has been the case since before COVID, even during COVID, we thought the market would slow down a bit, and it really didn't. So there is huge demand in Ireland. As an economy, we're a very wealthy economy. Employment is at a really great height. Our demographic is that people want to buy. And the issue is clearly that there's not enough supply of homes. And there's not enough supply of affordable homes. So what the government have done over the last number of years is bring in certain schemes that would try and help people with their deposit or bridge the gap between the purchase price and the mortgage amount. And in some ways, that could be seen to stimulate home building, to stimulate the market, the new home market, because they're all for the new home market.
Yeah.
But there's just not enough. Like, there's 30,000 homes built last year, and it was like, you know, there was some applause or self-applause that this was great. Mm-hmm. It was more than we expected. But again, those homes aren't coming to the market for people to buy, to people to mortgage, I suppose, and families to move into. So until there is more supply of new homes, then there's always going to be this issue. Mm. The government can, you know, they can do certain things in terms of tax or in terms of stimulus in the market. But the huge thing is that there's such a pent-up demand. So it's not just that this is a year, 2 years. This has been ongoing for so long. This housing crisis is, you know, has been in place for years. Yeah. And it's just that pent-up demand that is now really nearly reaching breaking point for people and causing such a challenge and such, you know, people want a home for security. People want to move on with their lives. People want to, you know, it's not a big ask if you're somebody who's working and contributing and can afford to repay a mortgage. Yeah. It's not a big ask to have homes in a country where you want to live, totally. Right? So there's no one, I suppose, magic silver bullet, right, that will help. Mm-hmm. The government have a Housing for All initiative that they came out with, that where they're looking at trying to, again, bring more homes to market. And it's not just for home buyers, it's for, you know, social housing, rent to buy, etc. But I don't think there ever could be enough done, right? Mm. But there's clearly hasn't been enough done. And because there hasn't been enough done for consecutive years, it's just like completely just spiraling right now. Mm. So I think the government could do more. A number of different things.
Though. I know we'd spoken about it, and you mentioned how while they are coming down the track, they're not eligible for mortgaging. So, and a lot of that seems to be the investment funds coming in and buying them all up for buy to rent? Is that the correct terminology?
Yeah, so they would come in. There is a market there, right, that needs homes to rent, right? Not everybody wants to buy or is in a position to buy. So there's a need for rental properties. But when funds come in and they actively buy full blocks, you know, as part of investment, so they're investment funds, that is really, really difficult pill to swallow for anybody who works in this industry or trying to buy a home, where you're excited about a new development coming up and you go in and you go, actually all gone. Yeah. And who has bought it? A fund. Like, how could that have been allowed for so many years?
I read this article, and this was 2021 or maybe 2022, but like 80 senators and TDs that were in power were landlords. So there's a conflict of interest there, I feel, that like, they're not going to hammer down on that.
These are really large, though, institutional investors as a part of individuals. So most of those senators were probably back in Celtic Tiger times where most people had a buy-to-let, I know, you know, rightly or wrongly. Yeah. But yeah, I do think from a tax perspective, and, you know, that could be perceived as a conflict of interest. But these are like institutional investors. These are big funds that come in and buy, and they buy for investment purposes. Right, they buy to make money, they buy, you know, and they had the opportunity to do that for a number of years because there was the tax environment in Ireland allowed it. Now they've tightened up on that somewhat, but, you know, you have to think all of those homes that were there, the horse slightly bolted on that. It should have been done earlier. Mm. And I think it's something that we have to be so mindful of going forward. If we're saying we're going to be building new homes, are those homes going to be available to buy? Can a normal person buy it? And are they going to be affordable? So that's another element. You know, you've so many people who are locked out. So people say, oh, great, there's, you know, the Help to Buy and the, but I still can't afford to buy a home because they're just, you know, the cost of a new build is so expensive. So there's no one answer, but there's certainly more that could be done. You know what I mean? It's such a problem now that it needs really great minds behind it, which maybe outside of the government, to really row in to come up with some sort of a solution or start to edge, because people are just sick of listening to the fact that something's been done about it, but still on the ground, as they'd say, you know, it doesn't come through as clearly.
Yeah. This leads into my next question, and it was actually on Ireland AM yesterday, and they said in Q1 of 2024, the average house price is now 527,000. So, like, how can banks value overpriced houses? So, for the likes of, like, a 3-bed in Dublin is, like, priced at 527,000 average.
So, from a bank's point of view, the value is always what somebody's willing to pay for it.
Okay.
So, they will lend at 90% on the basis that if the market drops, they still have that 10% position. And we all know what happened in boom times. The market dropped and people were in negative equity.
Yeah.
it's hard to see for me working with clients and seeing the demand and the desire to own a home, right? It's hard mm-hmm. for me to see that prices will go down. We've seen that mm-hmm. there was double digit figure, you know, increases up till probably last year, and now it's down to single digit. Mm-hmm. But the population, the demographic, the high employment rates in Ireland, the wealth that's still in the country would lead you to think that it would be hard to see prices drop. We saw interest rates increase, which normally last year and this year, which normally would lead to reductions in pricing, and it didn't. So that kind of all those economic indicators would show that these prices are what somebody is willing to pay now, and that's why the banks will value them at that level.
And like, what do you think needs to happen then for affordability? Like, what? Because, I mean, the house prices that are going at the moment, a lot of people can't afford them, or like, you know.
So I suppose in my really simplistic view, and without being the economist, I suppose like the thing I would look at is, I would say like, if you have demand, anything that's in demand, the price goes up, right?
Yeah.
So if you have more supply, then that will in some way dampen price inflation, because mm-hmm. there'll be more of it, you know?
Yeah.
But that, the problem is, the lack of supply always means that demand outstrips it, and then prices go up or will remain high. So it all comes down to the same solution of more homes, creating more affordable homes, creating homes in the right place. And that's the massive challenge. God, girls, I feel like I've dropped the tone here.
It is. Our shoulders are
like, we're all like,
it's pretty crap. I don't know if people just say this to try, it's nearly like a coping mechanism, but like, people are always holding out for this crash. Like, can anybody predict a crash in terms of housing? And do you think it's going to happen?
I've been through one because I've been a broker for so long, and I bought before a crash, right? And even back then, when I purchased my first home in 2004, there was 100% mortgages. There was apartments being built left, right, centre, right? You know, and it still was challenging at that time to actually buy, weirdly enough, because you could get the finance. There was houses, but there was such a demand for housing then. And then I have been, you know, through, I've been a broker for so many years that, you know, I've been through the crash and seen people struggle and seen that negative equity position, how difficult that was.
Yeah.
And right now, like, it's hard to predict a crash, I suppose, when there's still the demand and when the economy is doing so well. And I don't know if anybody, you'll correct me here, but I was going to say, I don't think anybody wants a crash. But I guess, like, we all want prices to be more affordable, but we don't want to go back to where the economy was back then. But like, it's hard to predict. It's hard to predict. You know, you'll have people who will say, you know, it's overheating and there's whatever. But it's very difficult to tell. It wasn't a great place to be. Like, there was a problem, obviously. There was negative equity, right, in the homes. But people lost their jobs. There wasn't the economy wasn't as it was now.
Yeah.
And that led to, like, you know, it's one thing borrowing money and not being able to pay back, which so many people weren't in a position to do it at the time. That is just a horrendous position to be in.
Bleak on a whole other level.
Yeah, totally.
And it was like, there was so much supply then and no demand, whereas it's the other way around now. I know we're in a housing crisis. Yeah, we could say this a million times on the podcast, but like, it just feels like the aftermath of the Celtic Tiger has something to do with that as well. Like, I think our generation, Niamh, everybody tells us, like, we will be the ones that will, and other people affected too, we're the ones that will pay for the fun of the Celtic Tiger. You know, do you think that has anything to do with this?
Yeah, it's funny. I'm like, as an older woman, I'm like, you're elder here, right? No, but I bought it at a different time as well. And so I went through that Celtic Tiger crash type thing. So I don't know. Obviously, clearly, like, your generation looking to buy now, it is immensely challenging. The statistics would show it's never been more difficult to buy. So you'd have to think that whether it's post Celtic Tiger or just government policy or just a perfect storm of wars and COVID and what else do we can we throw at it?
Yeah.
You know, COVID did have in terms of supply as a factor. The cost of build now is a factor, and that's to do with obviously war, etc. So, you know, and interest rates, all of that impacts, you know, supply and pricing and inflation, and all of those things have been sitting with us since, you know, for a long time post crash as well. So yeah, I am lucky enough to have my home now. Sometimes I kind of go, I just need to get rid of the mortgage, but I have the house. You know, but I'm so lucky to have my home, and you know, it's if I had to go back again to buy, it's not a nice place to be, and it's not a nice place to be anytime. It's immensely challenging to buy a home, and it's immensely stressful. But yeah,
but with the Celtic Tiger, like, do you think that that has had an impact on the lending rules?
So back then, right, you could borrow 100% finance. You could potentially borrow five times your income. Yeah. So that wasn't great, right? Mm. None of my clients come to me really going, I want to borrow loans.
They go,
I just want to buy a home. And they actually just want an affordable home. Mm. And actually, I really think that, your generation, right? Really kind of calling out like I'm your mum now here. But I think right now people are quite sensible. Mm. Like when I bought my first home, I was like, right, how much can I get?
Yeah.
What can I buy? Yeah. You know, and you
cool
kind of think about like paying the back. Right, where now people go, well, actually, but then if I did, or if we had a family, and then if there was creche. So I think people now who are buying do have that like thought of, they are very obviously frustrated at how much they have to borrow to buy a home, and therefore how much they have to repay. But they're very conscious of not overstretching themselves, even though it's really difficult not to do so when you're trying to buy, if you know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
It's, I think people are very conscious, and especially because we're in a kind of a higher interest rate environment now than we were, people are looking at repayments and saying, God, you know, we can't go above this. And again, that is challenging when you're looking to buy a home if you're restricted in terms of budget, obviously.
Yeah, because I did read somewhere that like Irish banks, you're required to hold more than twice the level of average capital compared to European banks.
So yeah, that was a reason why, say, when a bank is lending, right, they have to make sure to be solvent. Post-crash, the EU came over and went, oh my God, you guys, you need to be here. Yeah. So they increase the level of capital reserving that a bank has to have. So if they're lending to you, to make sure they're solvent, they have to hold funds here, so that if you didn't pay that back, suddenly they wouldn't become insolvent. They'd have the money to continue. So Germany were less hulak than we were during the boom time, so they have to hold less reserves. So the rules that were put in place to make sure that Ireland was seen as a good credit risk externally were around capital reserving. And because the banks have to hold more capital when they're lending, it costs them more to lend. So that would be why, you know, it would always be called out that it's more expensive to borrow in Ireland than, say, Spain.
Yeah,
right? Spain
has
been 2%, and you could get a 2% mortgage for 30 years, etc. Whereas in Ireland, it was always more expensive. And that was one of the reasons the banks would say, because it costs more to do business in Ireland, it costs more to lend because they've more capital reserving, they have a higher cost base, and they've more bad debts. Because in Ireland, a good thing is socially is that it is very difficult for a bank to repossess a home. So if you are in arrears, they cannot repossess your home as quickly as they can just in some countries.
Oh, really?
So therefore, yeah, for the banks, they say, okay, well, because we have to have bad debt provisions, because we've capital reserving, because it's more expensive to operate in Ireland, we charge more.
Or so
they say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's your opinion on the developers such as Cairn Homes posting record profits and not reducing the sale prices?
They are a business, right? So they, unless there is a restriction on them, they're there to make money. They have, they would say, big risk. They can sometimes have big reward, right?
Right.
And they're building in multiples. And building has to be seen as being profitable, or builders won't build, right?
Yeah,
and especially when, and I'm saying this in a kind of a devil's advocate way, right?
Yeah,
I would love if there was a cap on the price or the profits, but who can bring that in? So the government want to stimulate building, right? So they're not going to excessively, tax developers necessarily.
Okay.
And big companies like Cairn, I suppose they build enough multiple to make money. And I know it's really hard to see excess profit, but I don't think there's a way to curtail that. I think, you know, the government would have to bring in some sort of cap or levy or... And that's not their priority now. Their priority is to continue to get Cairn to build homes. So it's a challenge. Like it's like anything. It's like, you know, when people were saying, why don't the central bank, you know, restrict interest rates? Or, you know, if you start bringing in, I suppose, regulatory forces or levies and stuff like that, it can sometimes impact it in a negative way.
Okay.
So, it's hard to see those massive profits when people are like, oh my God, you can't buy a home at that level. It's unaffordable. But if they don't build, It's going to be another challenge. True.
And then what would be your opinion be on, like, I suppose, the second time homes and the bidding wars that are going on? Do you think they could bring in some sort of, like, someone going to value the house to be like, okay, well, you cannot sell this for more than 80 grand than its valued price?
Yeah.
Or let's just say they got an extension. So let's just say there was two houses next door to each other. One hadn't been touched since it was bought and it's like 50 years old and whatever. And the house next door had, I'd say, about, you know, 100 grand worth and an extension. I would see, yeah, that house going for the house that the extension's done. If they put money into it, it's obviously worth that amount. But the house next door is just going for like 10 grand under the price. But I just, I'm like, make it make sense. Because, you know, like the house, that house, okay, maybe it's in an okay area, but the house price, that's not worth the house price.
I'm loving this, Nessa, because it's like so obvious that he was bidding on this.
Yeah. Did you go through something?
He's like, I think they should stop us.
I just want your opinion because I'm just like, it's kind of like make it make sense.
I know.
And he's asking
it.
For a friend.
I get it.
I'm asking for me.
It's so hard, right? Because it's,
solve all the
second
problems.
Second-hand properties and bidding wars are my pet peeve because I have clients that have gone, we're going to bid, right? And I'd be like, oh, right. And say, any update, right? What's happening? And they'd be like, it went for 40 grand more. And they're like, so demoralizing and frustrating, okay? Yeah. So it's really hard. Like, auctions do that, right? So you're in a room and somebody's bidding and you know straight away you buy it and you bid it. But it'd be very hard to put some sort of a regulator in that said, okay, you can't sell that house for more than X because that would be messing with the market, right? So what somebody's willing to pay for it is what it's worth. And if you were selling a house and somebody came in and said, you're not allowed to sell it for more than that, you'd be like, hey, is that fair?
Yeah.
So
it kind of just is what it is at this point, isn't it? I know that's the pitch.
It is. Now, I do think, right, like as you've seen, like a property goes up for X and, you know, it goes for 100 grand more. You have to kind of go, was that a reasonable price to put it up for? Because you have people who are wasting their time.
When we were selling our house, the agent was like, well, we'll put it at this to get people through the door. But like we had a figure, which is so bad, but like on full transparency, you're batting for the team you're on. When you're selling, you're trying to get as much as you can, you know? But I remember being like, oh, that's so bad.
You're like, okay.
No, we're like, I really,
like, okay,
I really fell for them, but like, you know.
No, it's hard. Why at every stage you wanted that money to put into your new home. Like, the market is just hard at every stage.
Yeah.
There's new apps, right, that have come in that you bid online. And that's supposed to make it more transparent and better. And I actually go, girl, I think that's actually even worse, right? Because you register for an app and I'm on it and I'm bidder A and you're bidder B and you're bidder C, right? And I might bid whatever and you come back and you bid and then you're going, oh, God. But you don't engage necessarily with the agent. So old school, right? Or most people would ring an agent and say, I saw that house with you, I'm really interested in it and I want to put, you know, a bid of 400,000 on it. And because you're speaking to somebody and you're engaging, it's not like this, whatever. You know, I've seen on those apps, you know, bids at 20 to 11 on a Saturday night after a bottle of wine. And that's maybe just in my head I'm thinking this. But you know what I mean? You kind of, I think there's something like it has to be, you know, when you're bidding, it has to be like, it has to be as transparent as possible. Are the bidding apps more transparent than actually having to put in a bid and make that offer and be genuine and know you're, you know, chain free or you're not or you're whatever, you know?
Well, it's funny that you say that. Like, so a friend of mine was convinced, he was going for a house and they were putting bids in. And he was convinced it was like the family members. So the money would go up and up and up, trying to get the most out of, because it was online.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm not convinced that this is a real, like an actual person. I feel like this is someone in their pack.
Every one of my clients think that, right? So it's really hard, right? It's really hard because you're there, right? And you're going, and the agent comes back and they go, well, the other bidder, you know, has gone up by 10,000. You're going, really? Who's that? Yeah. Who? And you're kind of going, do it. And it's all, because it's such a closed process, you're always going to think, is this real, right? But I would say that a state agency, like they have to, when they're recording a bid, they have to record the bidder, they have to record all the details. So it is more regulation than it ever was. And I think when you're in that process, you're always going to be like, who are they? And they're not getting it. Or when you go viewing houses, you suddenly become really, do they look like they have money? Are you looking at their cars?
Yeah.
You're like, you know? So you do become super competitive. And because it's such a closed process, you're always going to think, was there somebody there? Did I just go up 20,000 to buy? You're crazy. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the bidding can be crazy. And it's like, you know, I'll always be talking to clients and it's like the conversations that I have, you know, it's always like, they've come back and they're 10. And so will I go in and try and blow them out of the water and put in or will I put it? And, you, and it's all, you never know, right? You don't know. All you can do is like, and a lot of people, you go view a house and you're going, I can see the Christmas tree be over there and I can, what I do is it, and you have it in your head. And it's so hard when you lose out or when somebody comes back with another bid and you're after them waiting 3 days, you think this is definitely the one.
You're in the clear.
It's so hard. Oh, no, yeah.
Yeah. It's so funny when you mentioned when you're looking at their cars, like when we've been going to a couple of viewings, like there's been these gorgeous, like Mercedes Jeep pulled up and then a Tesla. It's like, what time we're going to
drive on?
We're going to be outbidded here. Yeah. Like, might as well just move on. Us rocking up in our little Golf, hoping for the best.
You never know.
Posy vibes.
Definitely. And actually, I will say, right, bringing the posy vibes,
pick it up off the floor, Martina.
Our clients, like, we have a Sail a Great pipeline and every day it's like a yay, right? Because you can see people every day that are going Sail a Great, and some of them would be like just new clients and some of them would be months and you'd be like, brilliant. Yeah. So every day we have loads of clients go Sail a Great. So we have lots of applications as well, but we have a lot of clients. So the market is active and people are buying all the time. And then when you do go Sail a Great, you're like, nothing, but this cannot fall. This cannot fail. You're like obsessed and it's such an emotional time as well. Yeah. So with our clients, they go Sail a Great, they go, I have to sign contracts in 21 days and I have to do that, you know, and you're so worried that it's going to fall out.
Yeah.
And very few fall through. All you ever hear is the horror stories of yes and the gazumped and whatever else, which is horrendous, right? Mm. But in my experience, very few fall through. The only ones that would generally you'd see an issue would be if there's a problem with planning or retention, or if there's, you know, structural issues with the property and you get a survey and whatever else. So most people can have the confidence that when they put their booking deposit down and their sale agreed, things will progress. Like the vast majority of our clients will go through that process. And during that whole process, from becoming Sail a Great to closing, they're like on edge, right? Yeah. Until they get their keys. And again, it's that moment we'll be going, are you so excited? And they go, oh, I don't know. And you kind of, actually the weird thing is when you do go Sail a Great, it's that, it's not even the least, you're going, do I actually want it now? Like you start questioning everything about it.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a roller coaster. But I will again say that, you know, clients, all of our clients buy at some point. Sometimes people's journey are longer than others and more difficult than others, and they have to make more compromises than, you know, they planned initially.
Yeah,
Martina, that was all amazing, and I know you fascinated me and Nessa there, and I just feel like so many people are going to get so much from all of that. But we have our listener questions, and some have been piping hot. Because this one is for sure, because I have two best friends who are it's about my braces, I can't pronounce sometimes, single applicants, okay? Is there any loopholes or any advice for those like getting a mortgage? Because I feel like it does feel impossible when you're, especially with the house prices at the moment.
So house prices at the moment, because they're so high, unless you have an amazingly high income, right? Mm. Or your joint incomes, it is really, really difficult and challenging for single applicants. So I would always have single applicants saying to me, this feels like I am never going to be able to buy, okay? And a lot of the time, it's like having that conversation of, okay, this is, sometimes if you know what the options are, you can kind of think, okay, well, where are the solutions? They're not the one I want, but like what could, and come up with some options. So I'll always talk to clients and say, first of all, okay, are you aware of everything that exists in terms of the first home scheme, the help to buy scheme in particular, are really, really that first home scheme, bridging the gap between what you can borrow and your savings. And again, if your savings as a single applicant, it's hard to get 10% as a single applicant again.
Your rent.
So exactly. Well, yeah. And you know, and that's the reality of it. So the first home scheme, I think, is a really, really good one. We have really successfully worked with a lot of our single applicants. Again, it's new builds, so it's not everybody's cup of tea. But if you're looking as a first-time buyer and you're a single applicant and you're saying, everything's out of my range, perhaps the first home scheme works. You know, first, our new builds might be your dream property, but it doesn't have to be for your forever home either. Mm-hmm. If you want to just get on the property ladder, you know, you might be living further out than you want to be. But then there's looking at other options. Everybody in Ireland, we're focused on houses. We love houses, like we love gardens and all the rest, right? And it's brilliant. Like, that's great. But apartments can always be a really good solution for a single applicant. So we'd have so many people who are living in the city, they're working in the city, their social lives are in the city, and they're saying, I'd love to buy a house and I need, you know, 500,000 for it or whatever else. And you're kind of going, do you, you know, not to sound, but like, would an apartment be an option for 3, 4, 5 years?
Just feel like you need to get a house else. So,
yeah, and actually, what's better, you know, city centre living, not mowing a garden on a Saturday, like all those good things. Mm-hmm. So it's trying to, I suppose, look at other options and look at, kind of say, you know, how about this? Or thinking about it, there's no way to put it other than it's really not easy. If you've a single income, purchasing a property in Dublin, looking, or anywhere really, because nationwide property prices have gone up as well, and having to pull together that 10% deposit. So you really need to lean on any support that's available for you, which again, right now is just for new homes. Mm-hmm. So it is that help to buy in the first home scheme. And then it's just trying to take it in stages. So the property you might be buying now might not be for your forever home. And that's okay too, because, mm-hmm. you know, people move. I've moved multiple times actually. It doesn't always have to be your forever home initially, and it's trying to find those steps and just feel like, because what most people want is just to feel like they have their own space, that they have their own security, that they have their own home. That's like the big thing. Yeah. What size or where that comes to, you know, or from or whatever is a different story. So single buyers, and I think single buyers need more support. You're buying on your own, you've friends obviously, but it's like, you know, they're the big wins actually when single buyers who've been looking for so long go sale agreed, and it is a massive challenge.
Yeah. Another question that came in a lot, and no surprise, because I think like 21,000 people emigrated last year. Yeah. It seems all to Australia. Yeah. But all the questions kept coming in. Can you get a mortgage in Ireland when you're living abroad?
Yeah, so we would do expat mortgages. So some people would be living in London, some would be in Australia, America, wherever it is. And they think, I'm going to be coming home in, say, 5 years or 2 years, but I really want to buy before I come home. Or I'm coming home next year, but I don't want to rent because renting is nearly as difficult as buying actually at the moment, you know, in terms of getting a rental property, particularly if people with families. So some of the lenders, not all, will allow you to take a mortgage in Ireland while you're living overseas. So it'll be a non-resident FX mortgage if you're earning non-euro. The rules are more restrictive. You have to have a 30% deposit. But some of my, difficult, right? But some of my clients who are living in, say, Hong Kong or Singapore or Dubai, and the tax rate is much better, and they're coming home with a pot of cash. That works well. So not for everybody, but certainly you can take a mortgage when you're working and living outside of Ireland and when it's you're earning non-euro.
That's really interesting. I didn't know that. That's really positive.
Yeah.
You know, because like they are on a lot more money.
Yeah, they would. And, you know, and you don't have to have that clear route home. So you're buying it as if it's like, you know, your home. The banks generally won't allow you to offset a rental income against it because they're classing it as a home and you're getting home loan rates. And again, the number of lenders that allow it are restrictive. Even actually if you're living in Ireland, and a lot of people did, you know, COVID especially, they're still contracted to and they're working from home for a UK company, they're earning sterling. That can be challenging as well when you're looking to take out a mortgage, because not every lender will allow, because you're repaying a euro loan, but you're earning sterling. So it's more difficult for somebody who's living in Ireland, earning non-euro, so sterling or whatever, to buy and to take a mortgage in Ireland. So, but it is possible, but just a little bit more difficult.
That was positive.
Yeah. And another question that came in, need renovations of about 80k. Can I get a mortgage top up as I have about 200k equity in a mortgage?
Yep. And absolutely. So when the banks are looking at mortgage top ups, so you have a mortgage, you want to do home improvements, they will allow you to borrow up to 90% of the value of your home, presuming you can afford it, right? So you're eligible for that higher mortgage amount. So you would take a top up to do those home improvements. Some people would take a home improvement loan and then want to consolidate that into their mortgage, or for various different purposes. Sometimes people take top-ups to their mortgage for educational purposes or other different reasons, really, debt consolidation to some degree. But certainly to do home improvements, you can. And the big thing, if you're looking to release equity to do home improvements, is if you improve your building energy rating, I know I said this earlier, kind of repeat myself, but I'm obsessed with the lowest rates in the market. So if you improve your building energy rating to B3 or above, and there's lots of grants, again, coming back to Dermot Bannon and his home improvements, there, you know, there's a lot of grants available if you can, you know, the SEAI grants for insulation and windows and doors and all the rest. But if you can bring your energy rating to a higher rate, sometimes we would have clients who would be releasing equity, and actually because they can improve the rate on their overall mortgage, the piece they're taking out actually costs them very little, because, you know, from a cash flow point of view, they're used to paying 2,000 a month, and they're borrowing another 70, but they're able to get a much better rate than the overall mortgage. So it's costing them very little to finance that additional amount. So absolutely, you can take a top up.
Oh, amazing.
Kind of another mortgage top up question. So for a mortgage top up, how does that work and what is the criteria? Like, do you have to save for a deposit again, or how does that work?
No, the equity in the home itself will be your deposit, but you do have to show it's affordable. So if you're looking to borrow another 50,000 or 70,000, you know, you'll need to save 300 euros, for example, or whatever, for the 6 months before. So you can say, I'm paying my mortgage and I can show that I can afford this. Or if you're consolidating, say, an existing home improvement loan, you'll be paying the repayment, making the repayment on that loan anyway.
Okay.
So it'll show that it's affordable.
Okay.
And the big thing I would say is, when you're looking to do top-ups or home improvements, like, we're massive advocates of mortgage switching. So mortgage switching is where you have your mortgage with X lender, you're rolling off a fixed rate and you're saying, okay, well, what rates will you offer me to your bank? And they send you a schedule of rates and you're going, they're a little bit high, right? Especially now. What other rates could you get on the market? And you switch your mortgage from one bank to another to save on interest. Okay. So you'll only ever switch if there's a financial gain to do so. So when you're looking at topping up your mortgage or taking out a new mortgage, you'll have to go through that application process anyway. So you should really wrap that up into, what other mortgage can I get out there? Can I get a better rate? Because we're, as an Irish consumers, we're so bad at switching, right? It's like, even though there's savings that can be made, my husband will always say to me, no, switching, you could save, say, 250 euros a month. And if you were meeting somebody every month that was giving you 550 euro notes, you'd be like, I'll meet you, right? People go, oh, I don't know if I'm going to go through that.
Yeah.
And it's because when they bought, they associate the mortgage with the stressful time of purchase.
Yeah.
So they kind of, but when you're switching, it's like moving from one to the other to save on interest. Yeah. So everybody coming to the end of a fixed rate should not just look at their own lender, because your lender isn't going to be competitive for the next 30 years that you take out your mortgage. You have to look at switching, because interest is so needless. Like, it's not like, it's like your electricity. If you change from one product to another, the same electricity is coming out, right? So it's like, it doesn't impact your mortgage, but you're just paying less.
So it's
so important.
Yeah.
Another question. This person is ready to buy now. This is so funny. I actually thought of this as well. Ready to buy now. Should I wait a year? Will the market be any better?
It's so hard,
right?
Yeah, because if we look back to last year, and anybody who would have waited would be like, oh God, it isn't any better, you know? And it depends on your circumstances and if you're paying rent. You know, it's so hard to put a pin and go, when would be the best time to buy, right? And sometimes if a house your deposit, if a house comes up, you have to go for it, right? And it could take from the time, not to really discourage anybody, but it could take from the time you decide to buy until you actually buy, it could take a year, right? So if you wait and try and, you know, predict that perfect time, it's going to be really difficult. The good thing I'd say about the moment is that, you know, interest rates have leveled off. It's expected that hopefully we'll start to see a smaller dip in rates over the coming year, 2 years. So that could, again, spur on the market, right? That's the other thing. If it's cheaper to borrow, you know, the market could increase. But it's hard to see the market drop. So I think you have to always be open and ready and understand the market. I think really a big thing is, a year before you want to buy, look at what properties are going for in your area. So if you go to a house and, you know, it's on for 500,000, it sells for 6, and you're going, okay, well, that one for 6, you're able to build in your mind your own kind of diary of, well, that one. And so when you're bidding, you can say, well, I looked at a house last year that was this, and that's why I'm bidding why, you know, or whatever. So I think it does take time to do your research, understand where you want to buy, to go to viewings, and that takes time. So if you're pushing it out for a year hoping that the market might drop, I would say be open to buying if you want to buy now, because if something comes up, then, you know, it's a good idea to go for it if you can.
And keep saving. Just because you're approved doesn't mean you, because I didn't know that. I need to put my savings in again.
Yeah.
I will be saving anyway. We're getting married this year. But it's good to know that, just in case you do need to renew your application, that you need to be seen.
Absolutely.
You know.
So when you apply for a mortgage in that 6 month period, and we'll have spoken and we'll have said, okay, this is what you need to do in general. And then when somebody gets approval, they're like, great, that's me done now. But actually, if you don't buy a home during that 6 months, you have to reapply. And the bank will say, be like, as if they've never seen you before, apart from the fact that you'll have the comfort you'll be approved, because you'll have been approved before. Mm-hmm. But the bank are like looking at it as if clean slate. Just, okay, I need to review it now based on what I've in front of me. Income, affordability, etc. So just be mindful of that. Until you draw down that mortgage, you could be asked at any stage to provide income documents or evidence of affordability. So just be really mindful of general spend and just position until you draw down your mortgage and after it, but until you draw it down, especially.
Do you need to be permanent to get a mortgage? This question came in from a substitute teacher.
Not necessarily. So again, the bank's always looking at how sustainable your income is, and can they take a view that based on how long you've been working in the position, you know, are there permanent teachers who are on permanent contract or contracts of indefinite duration? There'll be never a question that's like permanent. Mm. So temporary teachers, if they're paid over the summer or if they're not, or how long they've been a temporary teacher, generally we'd back that up with a CV. We'd back that up with just like everybody knows there's a shortage of teachers.
Yeah.
So, but it's just to put the background to it so the bank knows and understands, is it their first contract? Right. Again, are they paid over the summer? How will they afford the mortgage over the full year if they're not? That kind of thing.
Okay.
So permanency for almost all applications is something that's really, really, you know, a positive. But if you're not permanent, depending on the position and how much you can show, you know, history of, you know, what your occupation is, what industry you work in, what your profession is, that all stacks up. It just would need, not every lender will allow you to borrow as a, you know, a temporary teacher, etc. And that's why it's so important to go, you know, not just go to one lender, that you understand what all lenders will offer.
And to get a broker.
Yeah, I didn't want to say broker. That. Was that obvious? That?
No. I was like, I'm picking up what you're putting down. I'm gonna get it for you.
Yeah.
I suppose this is actually a good question, because this is one that was on kind of my radar. If your job doesn't offer maternity leave, will this impact you when you're going for a loan?
No. So a bank will always ask, you know, if you're due to go on maternity leave, what's the expected return date from mat leave? Are you going to be on unpaid leave?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in general, there's no issue if you're due to be going back to work on X date. That's the question solved. No change to your terms and conditions. For somebody who's self-employed, it's slightly different, because you will have your state benefit.
Mm.
But, you know, I would always say if you're self-employed, try and hold back. And if you're family planning, etc., try and hold back some money so that you have something to cover over that period.
Yeah, yeah.
And especially, again, if you're looking to apply for a mortgage and you're self-employed, they're going to look retrospectively. So we can explain to the bank that the income was lower that year because of maternity leave, but in general you're not going to be penalised, or if you were, I'd have something to say to the bank about it, so we'd be all right there.
Yeah.
But I did have one situation where a client was working in the UK and they were saying, well, you know, she's on maternity leave, is she going to go back to that job? And I was like, would you ask Amanda?
Yeah.
Who's going to mind his child? So they kind of went, okay, proved right.
Last question. Somewhat positive, right? Somebody has got a mortgage, okay? They managed to buy a house. Should you clear your mortgage early if you can?
Oh, like the lotto win, I'm still waiting for it. Yeah, no, absolutely right. The earlier you can clear your mortgage, the less interest you can pay is great, right? Because when you get your mortgage loan offer, it'll say the amount you're borrowing, and then it'll say the total cost of credit, and then you'll be like, oh, sorry, what's that figure, right? And there's nothing we can do about it. Interest is a necessary evil. A bank is going to lend to you, they're always going to charge interest. If you can clear lump sums off your mortgage, it has a massive impact. If you can clear your mortgage over a shorter term, it has a massive impact. But when most people are starting off, they're like, okay, well, by the time we get settled in, we want to keep a 30-year term in place or whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that as life changes and your circumstance, like, you know, my kids are older now, so I have less childcare costs and stuff like that, that you're not going to change the terms of your mortgage or drop the term down. So you're not paying it off until you're like 70 or whatever, you know, or whatever it is, that you can bring it back down. So at different stages of life, you'll be able to adjust your mortgage term or overpay on your mortgage, perhaps, just to ensure you, in your own mind, have an idea as to how you want to, when you want it to be cleared.
Yeah.
And absolutely, overpaying your mortgage is amazing if you can do so. Mm. Paying it off early means you pay less interest to the bank. So that's always a priority.
Mm. So let's just say I bought a house and it was next year, I won 30,000 on the lotto. And I put that just all against my mortgage.
You're going to blow it. You're not going to put it.
You said you'd go to Glasgow.
Don't put it on a helicopter.
Yeah,
yeah, I literally said that. What I said, I was like, I'll bring my friend.
Dare put it on the mortgage.
I'd be like, no.
Let's just say I did.
Yeah.
Would that reduce my mortgage repayments at all?
You can choose, right? So you can choose whether it reduces your mortgage repayment or you continue to pay the same repayment and it reduces the term.
Oh,
so
yes,
you, and that's the most effective way. So the last latter one where you're putting in the lump sum but you're continuing to pay means you've accelerated the repayment of the mortgage you'll clear it off more quickly.
What's more fun, that or Glasgow?
Oh my god,
a helicopter to Glasgow. Obviously, I was just thinking.
Martina, we have bled you dry.
No, I'm sorry. Clearly the love of nerd. I'm clearly a nerd. Nerd alert. Mortgages. No, but thank you, girls, for having me. It's great to be able to speak about it. You know, it's great to have interested people listening. Yeah.
And for people who just want to get in touch with Doddle, how would they do that?
So we have our website, so it's doddle.ie, doddl.ie, and they can input some details, we'll be straight back to them. We also have an Instagram page, which we try and put up useful content. So it's trying to
I think it's really good. When I think of a mortgage broker now, it would be the first that would come to my mind.
Oh my god, I love you, Nessa. Thank you.
Help me with my mortgage.
I suppose it's trying to just normalize things, because I think sometimes, and it's always like thinking of the bank mentality as well, of it's like it's really difficult. And yes, mortgages are really difficult to understand, but you don't need to know everything about them. You just need to know the basics of how you can pay as little as possible, get as much as you need, blah, blah, blah. So I really, the reason we called the business Doddle was to try and make it simple. And people are like, that's not a Doddle. Mortgages aren't a Doddle. Mm-hmm. But I suppose it's just try and make it relatable. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a big transaction for most people. And so it's trying to normalize it and whatever else. Yeah.
Okay, so Instagram, and their website.
Obviously call or whatever else. Yeah. But yeah, so we have a team of 45 mortgage specialists. Wow. So we would work with clients from start inquiry right through to completion, life cover, home insurance, all that type of product as well. So, and the aim of the game is just to make sure our clients get what they need and to try and be as supportive as possible through the process, because we get it, and we get how stressful it is and how hard it is. And there are, like, you know, silent inner claps when the clients do go sail agree, because we do actually, you're so involved with people, you kind of know them. Like, and one of my clients, you know, we were on all week, and then her husband said, oh, you know, we need a baby girl. I was like, oh my God, I know her. And I was going, we need to get this mortgage in before you have that baby.
We just had a baby.
So it is that, you just get involved.
The human element. Is
It's just so important.
Yeah. Honestly, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Martina.
Thank you both. You've kind of gone home to bed at this stage.
Doddle.ie, everyone.
Thank you, girls.
Thank you so much. I really hope you enjoyed that episode as much as me and Nessa did. It was such an informative chat. I felt like we grilled Martina, but I hope you got all the information that you needed. And we'll be back next Monday with another episode. And this is a Go Loud original podcast. Bye.
Bye.
This is Unveiled with Niamh Cullen and Nessa Morrissey, a Go Loud original podcast. Subscribe to this podcast for free on the Go Loud app.